All right, we'll be picking it up on page 542 in your notes, page 542. We are in chapter 50. We will get through this very long chapter tonight and enter into chapter 51, another very long chapter. But both of these exceptional chapters dealing with the destruction of Tribulation Babylon. In our time frames, we're in the tribulation period, a time future to us, also known as the time of Jacob's trouble. Chapters 50 and 51, basically all of 51, just a few verses of it, are not concerned with the tribulation period. We're all in the future. We're looking at the destruction of the Antichrist's worldwide capital. This is step three in the campaign of Armageddon, the destruction of Babylon. Step one, the Antichrist assembles his army at Armageddon or the Jezreel Valley. Then Antichrist joins his troops, and then we come to the destruction of Babylon. And out of the north, an army that we see will finally be named as the army of the Medes will come down upon Babylon, and the economic and political capital of the world during the tribulation will be vaporized, will be turned into a burning wasteland. Now, during the kingdom, we also learn that the Jewish people would occupy and thrive in areas that we do not occupy now. First, the Carmel, that area we do occupy and thrive in today. That's the Jezreel Valley, by the way. But the Bashan, very few Jewish people up there, that is a contested area. We've only lived up there for a few years, and Syria, you know, is threatening to go to war over Bashan. Whether we keep it or not, only the future will tell. The hills of Ephraim are not occupied by very many Jewish people today. There are some settlements there, but that basically is Samaria or the West Bank, the northern half of the West Bank today, so we're not thriving in that area. And no Jewish people live in Gilead today, which is northern Jordan today. So while in the future we will live and thrive in these areas, this has never happened yet. And so this is one of those pieces of evidence that tell us we have to push off these chapters into the future. Just one of many pieces of evidence. Finally, we learn that when Babylon is destroyed, it will become it'll become occupied by demons. We saw on page 541, first part of verse 39, that there will be inhabitants of Babylon, and that all the animals that were named in the first part of verse 39 are just guesses on the part of the translator. For example, wildcats, jackals, ostriches, all those terms are just guesses. We're not sure what these things are. And from other sections of Scripture, we learn that these are demons with animal-like features. And one of the other sections of Scripture that can confirm this... Whoops, did I go the wrong way? No, I didn't. Come on. One of the other sections of Scripture that confirm this, I need to read what's up on the board, is Revelation 18:2. When she's destroyed, Babylon has become a dwelling place of demons and a prison of every unclean spirit. So there will be some inhabitants of Babylon, but they will be demons. That'll be one of the two places during the kingdom where the demons are confined. Satan confined to the abyss. Yes. And they're the same. It's basically a synonymous term. Okay. All right. But there will be inhabitants. There will be inhabitants of Babylon. But on page 542, top of the page, we finish up verse 39 with the non-inhabitants. Point two on page 542. Everybody there? And this is Jeremiah 50, verse 39, second part of the verse. Let me start with the first part of the verse and continue through to the end. Therefore, the desert creatures will live there, along with jackals, and ostriches will also live in it. Those are the demons. And it will never again be inhabited or dwelt in from generation to generation. So the non-inhabitants of Babylon are people. People will never live there again. That is not true today, is it? We got plenty of people living in Babylon and the vicinity of Babylon today. In fact, we got thousands of troops in that area today. So it's not true today. Again, we have to push this off into the future. As we move to verse 40, We come to the finale, the close of this particular section, with a comparison. Babylon is compared to a couple of other very famous cities. Verse 40. As when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah with its neighbors, declares the Lord, no man will live there, nor will any son of man reside in it. So there's your comparison, Sodom and Gomorrah. So the point is repeated in verse 40 that when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah, nobody lived there anymore. Point B, point 3B, there's no permanent residence there. Point 3C, in the middle of the page, there are no temporary residents there. No people are going to live in Babylon. Exactly the same as Sodom and Gomorrah. Exactly the same as point D, Edom. What's true of Edom will be true of Babylon. With a look at the destruction of Babylon behind us, now the cause for this destruction comes into view. Point 9 in the middle of the page. And in verses 41 through 46, we deal with the invasion from the north. The gathering of the nations, of the invaders, is brought out in verse 41, chapter 50, verse 41. Behold, a people is coming from the north, and a great nation, and many kings will be aroused from the remote parts of the earth. So point A, the first part of the verse, stresses that one nation from the north is going to lead. A people, a great nation. But point B expands the idea. This one nation will be leading a coalition. Many others from all parts of the earth will join. And notice in verse 41 that many kings will be stirred up from the uttermost parts of the earth. So it's going to be a large coalition of rebels that come against the Antichrist and against his capital city, his world capital, during the tribulation period. Now there'll be major players in this coalition and minor players. We will look at the four major players later on this evening. We'll get a little closer look at this coalition, a little more detailed look later on. But right now, all we're told is that they come from all over the earth. In fact, you'll be surprised where one of the major players comes from. It was a surprise to me. It'll be a surprise to you. All right. Now, they're gathered in verse 41. As we move on to verse 42, we see that they attack. Verse 42. They seize their bow and javelin. They are cruel and have no mercy. Their voice roars like the sea, and they ride on horses, marshaled like a man for the battle against you, O daughter of Babylon. All right, a number of points describe the attack. Point A, they have bow and spear. In other words, they have proper weapons. They have the proper weapons to carry out this attack successfully. Now remember, Jeremiah is talking in terms that the people in his day and age could understand. If he had said they have M16s, nobody except the current generation would know what's going on. But as it is, even we know what bows and arrows are. Point B, their attitude is highlighted. Their attitude, cruel, merciless. In other words, they hate Antichrist, they hate his dictatorship, they hate his supporters. They hate the whole thing. That's their attitude. Cruel, merciless. Point C gives us a look at their numbers, at the size of the coalition. They are so large that their movement, the movement of these armies, causes a loud roaring as they travel. You know, like being by the seashore. You hear the constant rumble of the waves. Well, there are so many in this army that you hear the constant rumble of the soldiers and the equipment as it moves along. Page 543. Point D at the top of the page again emphasizes they are well equipped. They ride upon horses, well equipped. Point E tells us that this army is very organized and disciplined. Everyone is set in array. In other words, every soldier knows his job. Every soldier has been trained. This is not a ragtag bunch of sloppy peasants coming out with farming equipment. They are organized, they are disciplined, they are trained. Everybody knows his job. Finally, F. Point F tells us that they're focused. They know their mission. It's against you, O daughter of Babylon. They know very well why they are there. They know their mission. So they're ready. Now, point B in the middle of the page, verse 43, we come to the effects of this army upon the king of Babylon, upon the Antichrist. Now, you'll be surprised when you read this. I was surprised. The king of Babylon has heard the report about them, and his hands hang limp. Distress has gripped him, agony like a woman in childbirth. Now, the king of Babylon is not in Babylon when it's destroyed. He is not destroyed along with his capital city. Why? Up on the map here, remember step two of the campaign of Armageddon? The Antichrist leaves his capital city and he joins his troops in the Jezreel Valley. He will not be destroyed with his city. So he is not in his city when this news comes to him. And when he does receive this news, here's how he's described. What does he do? He panics. For point two, his hands are feeble. He gets weak. You know, it hits him and he sits down. You know, we say, you ready for the bad news? You better sit down. Well, that's what his advisors say to him. You better sit down, AC. And he does. He sits down. He's weak. He's so shocked. Okay. Point three there. Anguish has taken hold of him. He's distraught when he hears the news. He's shocked. He sits down. He's distraught. He's shaking. He's weak. He's feeble. Point four, he gets stomach cramps, pangs like a woman in travail. You know, when you go into a tense situation, my stomach hurts, you know. You get all knotted up inside. Well, that's what happens to him, to this man. So he loses courage at this moment. He's stunned by surprise. Why? Because these armies that were moving don't join him in the Valley of Jezreel. Movement of armies doesn't surprise him at all at this time. Remember step one? He's ordered that his armies assemble at Armageddon. Armies from all over the world. So the fact that this army is on the move doesn't surprise him. What surprises him is they don't join him in Jezreel. They line up against his capital city. That's the big surprise. But just like Adolf Hitler, he makes a very similar decision like Adolf Hitler. In World War II, when Hitler began to lose the war, did he wisely redeploy his resources to go to the Russian front and etc.? What did he do? His generals were steaming mad at him because he tied up a lot of resources in transporting Jews to the death camps. Okay, he used his trains, and he didn't supply his troops as well as he could have, because he was more interested in killing Jews than winning the war. And that was one of the aspects of why the war went down for him, because he diverted his resources to training Jews to the death camps. Same thing's going to happen here. Even though his capital city goes up in flames, the Antichrist is not going to redeploy his troops to go after the enemies here. What's he going to do? He's going to head south to Jerusalem, right? He's more interested in destroying the Jews than in winning this war. What's underneath all of this? Why would a man make decisions like that? Satan. There you go. He is energized and guided by Satan. Satan wants the Jewish people gone. You know, there's promises that God has given to us. If any one of the four covenants that God has made with the Jewish people fails in any one of its points, Satan's career is safe. But the instant that every single one of those covenants is fulfilled, and they will all come to fruition with the second coming in the Messianic kingdom, Satan knows that he is what? Burnt toast, literally. Okay? His career is over. And so that's why he energizes his instruments to destroy the Jewish people. That's the idea. Okay? It's Satan preserving himself. He doesn't care about Antichrist. He didn't care about Hitler. He wants the Jewish people destroyed. That's the same pattern that happens here. So Antichrist may panic and have a time of agony, but he will arise from his chair and he will order his armies south against Jerusalem. Nothing new. Nothing new. It's happened before. Alrighty, that's the effects on the king of Babylon in verse 43. Now why does this attack against Babylon come about? Well, we learn in verse 44 that this attack is totally under God's control. You know, Antichrist isn't the one controlling the nations of the world. He may think he is, but ultimately the King of Kings is, and he has his army as well. Verse 44. Behold, one will come up like a lion from the thicket of the Jordan to a perennially watered pasture. For in an instant I shall make them run away from it, and whoever is chosen I shall appoint over it. For who is like me? And who will summon me into court? And who then is the shepherd who can stand before me? Okay. Point C1 there. Behold, the enemy shall come up like a lion from the pride of the Jordan. Remember this picture? Again, that picture of the thickets of the Jordan where the lions would make their lairs. Good place to hide. They would leap out on unsuspecting prey suddenly. That's the picture of this attack on Babylon. This army from the north will leap upon the capital city as suddenly and unexpectedly as a lion leaping from the thicket. The perennially watered pasture is Babylon, watered by the Tigris and Euphrates River. So the initial destruction of Babylon will come about by man, but then in the middle of the verse, we see God intervene. Point 2a, a very strange comment is made. I will suddenly make them run away from it, speaking of the armies that have attacked Babylon. Apparently what God causes to happen here is he causes his army to retreat from Babylon. They come into Babylon, they wreak havoc in Babylon from a physical point of view, and then for some reason they retreat, and then point B comes into play. God ends the destruction of Babylon by raining fire and brimstone on it. In other words, we need to see Babylon turned into a burning wasteland like Sodom and Gomorrah. We need to see that happen. We need to have all the inhabitants of Babylon destroyed. Apparently, this is the way he does it. He brings his army in, they retreat, and then he does the coup de grace, finishes it off. And Babylon and the surrounding area is a burning wasteland. And when we come to point three, the point of parentheses three is God's sovereignty. The idea here is that God is in charge. He's the ultimate general. He's the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And did you see the rhetorical questions? Who is like me? None. Nobody. Who will appoint me a time? Nobody tells God when and where. He does it. He's the one who decides when and where. Who's the shepherd that can stand before me? He's the ultimate shepherd, the great shepherd. No one. No one has authority over him. That's his sovereignty in view. And so he will bring about this attack, and it will go exactly as he has planned. It may seem a little fantastic to us, but he'll make sure that it happens that way. And the fact that it will happen in the way that he describes is brought out on page 544. It's emphasized by the decree of God at the top. The decree of God is found in verse 45. Page 544, point D at the top, verse 45. Therefore, hear the plan of the Lord, which he has planned against Babylon, and his purposes, which he has purposed against the land of the Chaldeans. Surely they will drag them off, even the little ones of the flock. Surely he will make their pasture desolate because of them. Point one, the decree in your notes. The command here is plural. It's directed at all the nations of the world. It's directed at every single one of us who reads this verse. We're being directed, everyone, to pay close attention so that we can understand God's plan, so that we can understand His purpose, and so we can understand His results, the results He's going to bring upon Babylon. So listen up, everybody, is the idea behind the Hebrew there. And what are we all to learn? What are we all to integrate into our worldview? Point two, that he is going to destroy Babylon. Even the little ones of the flock. There's going to be no mercy shown. The little ones would refer to the weakest of the flock, the youngest. Everyone in Babylon will be dragged off to death. The picture of that lion, again, leaping out of the thicket upon a flock of sheep. Only this lion destroys the entire flock. So you can bet on it. So that's a decree of God for the world to understand. And when this happens, what effect will it have on the world? And the effects on the world are brought out in verse 46. Last verse of chapter 50. At the shout, Babylon has been seized, the earth is shaken, and an outcry is heard among the nations. So notice, this is worldwide in scope. There's a cry heard around the world. This is not something limited to the Middle East. This did not happen when Medo-Persia conquered Babylon. Now, what are the consequences that are going to be heard around the world? What is the mourning and grieving that he's talking about? Well, that mourning and grieving is brought out in Revelation 18, 9 through 19. Point 3. We won't read all of Revelation 18, 9 through 19, but we'll read the most important verses. We'll start in verse 9. Here's your first group. There's three groups who mourn and grieve the destruction of Babylon. Here is the first group. And the kings of the earth who committed acts of immorality and lived sensuously with her, and he's referring to Babylon in the context, will weep and lament over her when they see the smoke of her burning. So our first group is the kings of the earth. These are the lackeys of the Antichrist. They receive derived authority from him. He's the world, the dictator. And they align with him, and so they receive authority from him. And, you know, politicians get rich, don't they? Kings of the earth get rich. So they are going to mourn when they see the capital city destroyed. So that's the first group, mourning. Dropping down to verse 11 of Revelation 18, the second group that's mourning. And the merchants of the earth weep and mourn over her because no one buys their cargoes anymore. Well, the merchants grieve because of their greed. They want to sell their iPods, you know, and their computers and their cars and all the stuff that they got there. And they have no more markets because of the destruction of the economic capital of the world. So there's your second group. We have the kings of the earth, the merchants of the earth. And finally, we drop down to verse 17 through 19 of Revelation 18, and we learn of the third group. For in 1 hour, such great wealth has been laid waste, and every shipmaster and every passenger and sailor and as many who make their living by the sea stood at a distance and were crying out as they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, what city is like the great city? This will now be the Big Apple, huh? the big B, whatever it'll be called in those days. And they threw dust on their heads and were crying out, weeping and mourning, saying, "Woe, woe, the great city in which all who had ships at sea became rich by her wealth, for in 1 hour she has been laid waste." So here we see the shipping industry mourning the destruction of Babylon. Why? Well, the shipping industry is a major industry in this world, isn't it? You know, Toyota can't deliver very many cars by 747, can they? No, you can stack Toyotas up, you know, 20 high on a big cargo ship and take them across the ocean. What about the oil? We've got these huge oil tankers that plow the oceans of our planet now. Shipping is a big deal. If it's not the major transportation resource we have in this world, it's one of the major ones. And it will be in the tribulation as well. And again, this industry has no more economic capital to govern her. So we have the kings, we have the merchants, and now we have the shipping industry mourning the destruction of Babylon the Great. So that's worldwide in scope. Okay, now we move on to chapter 51. We're halfway through it. Halfway through this destruction of Babylon. And since God is repeating it over and over and over again, He wants us to remember this and get it. You know, He's pounding it into our head. So point 10, toward the bottom of the page, we come to the winnowing of Babylon. A picture is now drawn for us that depicts the destruction of the Antichrist capital. So we begin in verse 1 of chapter 51 with the destroying wind. Verse 51, or chapter 51, verse 1. "Thus says the Lord, Behold, I am going to arouse against Babylon and against the inhabitants of Lebkamai the spirit of a destroyer." Now, point 2 explains what this term Lebkamai means. In the Hebrew, it literally means the heart of my opponents. That's the literal term. But it is, point B there, an atbash for Kashdim. It's an atbash for the word Chaldeans. All right, Bob, what is an atbash? You guys remember what an atbash is? Here's that slide I showed you a while back. At the top of this slide, you see the Hebrew alphabet repeated twice. You'll see why I've repeated it twice up there. And this is what an atbash is. An atbash is of Jewish origin. It's a very simple thing. It's a simple substitution cipher for the Hebrew alphabet. In other words, the first letter of the alphabet in a word, instead of using that letter and writing out the word correctly, you use the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet. So say the first letter of your word is Aleph. Well, instead of writing an Aleph, you write a Tav. Okay, say the second letter of your word is a Bet. Second letter of the alphabet. Well, you don't write a Bet. You write a Sheen. And the same thing all right on down. Say the third letter. Or you need a Gimel, whatever this letter might be in the word. If you need a Gimel, you don't write a Gimel. You write a Resh. So you see the little code there? That's the little code. And so this word, Lebkamai, is an atbash for Kasdim. Now, commentators think that the reason that Jeremiah did this little code here, we've seen it before, lies in the fact that he's writing this during the time of Nebuchadnezzar. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar has just conquered Jerusalem in 586, and they think it might have been a bit dangerous for Jeremiah to say, I will raise up against Babylon. So I will come against them who dwell in Lebkamai. Jewish people would understand that it's, I will come against them, against the Chaldeans. And so it would kind of disguise what Jeremiah was saying, and maybe Nebuchadnezzar wouldn't figure out what's going on. Well, that's a possibility. Who knows? We'll have to ask Jeremiah when we see him, okay? Why did you use those atbashes when you did, Jeremiah? Now, page 545, at the top of the page, point 3. You read the phrase there, a destroying wind. This is the last phrase in the verse. Now, the American Standard Version, the Tanakh, the King James, and the New King James all render the phrase a destroying wind. Now, the NASB and perhaps some other translations render it. How did my render it? Verse, I will arise up the spirit of a destroyer. Now, a destroying wind is the better rendering of the phrase there. The Hebrew term for wind there is the term ruach. It's not the spirit of a destroyer. A destroying wind is a better translation. So I think the ASV, Tanakh, King James, and New King James handled the phrase better. And the reason I think they handled it better primarily is because of the context. Because in verse 12, the wind is very prominent. We're talking about the winnowing of Babylon here. So he's going to bring against the inhabitants of Leb Kamai a destroying wind. Against the Chaldeans, he's going to bring a destroying wind. And that's what we see in verse 2. I shall dispatch foreigners to Babylon, that they may winnow her and may devastate her land. For on every side they will be opposed to her in the day of her calamity. Okay, he's going to send strangers to winnow her. The strangers are the armies that come against her. Those are the strangers. Now, winnowing. What is winnowing? Just to make sure we all understand that, here's a picture of a man winnowing. You take the grain and you put it on the threshing floor and you thresh it, which separates the grain from the chaff. And then the easy way to disperse the chaff and keep the grain is to take a big fork like this. And when we go to Ne'ot Kedumim in November, perhaps we can witness this, because that's a biblical technology in view there. So this guy throws up, he sticks his fork into this pile and throws it up into the air. And you see all the lightweight stuff here? All the lightweight stuff is blown away by a gentle wind off to the side. And the heavyweight stuff, that's this big dark cloud up here. You can see it already starting to come down. The heavyweight stuff comes straight down. It isn't affected by the wind. And so you separate the wheat from the chaff that way. The point of verse 2 is not that there's going to be a constructive gentle wind that allows a constructive activity to occur. The wind is going to be so strong that it blows away chaff and wheat together. That's the idea here. I'm going to blow it all away. These strangers are going to come into Babylon and they're going to blow that threshing floor clean. Nothing's going to be left. That's the idea. He's going to definitely winnow her. In verse 3, we come to the command to the winnowers. And this again is the invading army again. Here they come. Here's God's command to them. Verse 3. Let not him who bends his bow bend it, nor let him rise up in his scale armor. So do not spare her young men. Devote all her army to destruction. And the point here is that the invading army is going to totally blow away Babylon. Devote all of her army to destruction. They will not defend themselves. We'll learn why in a little while. Not this week, but probably next week. And so the results in verse 4, speaking of Babylon, they will fall down slain in the land of the Chaldeans and pierce through in their streets. And so when the armies come in to winnow Babylon, the armies of the Babylonians, the armies of the Antichrist, will be decimated. That's the results of this winnowing of Babylon. Now we turn to page 546. And guess what? We've seen this before. Our attention is now directed to Israel. Remember? Back in question, Bonnie.
Yeah, you said before that AC and his armies were over in the Jezreel
Valley. Well, he has some troops in Babylon. He didn't leave Babylon defenseless. He leaves a little bit of a rear guard there, you know. Okay. We've seen this pattern before. Babylon, Israel. Babylon, Israel, right? Back and forth. Why? Just to remind you, the restoration of Israel comes in conjunction with the destruction of Babylon. That's what we're learning. Back and forth, back. We're not done doing that. And so now our attention jumps over to Israel. What's happening to Israel at this time? Verse 5. For neither Israel nor Judah has been forsaken by his God, the Lord of hosts, although their land is full of guilt before the Holy One of Israel. So here we have a reminder that Israel will not suffer the same fate as Babylon because Israel is not forsaken. And you see point 1b there, literally not widowed. She still has a husband. Her husband is the Lord. That's the picture there, a woman. Still is married, still has her husband to protect her. And who is this husband that protects Israel and Judah? It's Jehovah of hosts. Very clearly who this is. But notice point 3 in your outline, the last phrase of that verse. Though their land is full of guilt against the Holy One of Israel, even though Israel is marked by sin at this point, Jehovah is still our husband and has not forsaken us. God is a covenant-keeping God. He's got four eternal and unconditional covenants with the Jewish people that He will see are fulfilled. So He will not abandon us. He will not forsake us. And again, verse 5 here is just one of those little tiny statements that totally destroys replacement theology. Right? Remember, what does replacement theology teach? Replacement theology teaches that because of Israel's sins, God has cast her off and the church has replaced her. Okay? God really doesn't have any promises pending for Israel anymore. Okay, that's what replacement theology teaches. And it goes totally against the Word of God. And verse 5 is a good example. Now, the technical term for replacement theology is supersessionism. Might as well familiarize you with that little word. It's a very polite little theological word for replacement theology. So don't get buffaloed by it. This just comes out of Wikipedia. It's a fairly decent article. Supersession and replacement theology, they're basically the same animal, are modern terms for particular interpretations of New Testament claims that see God's relationship with Christians as superseding or replacing His prior relationship with ethnic Jews. That's replacement theology. The Jews are no longer God's people. Now, this started very early. This has been going on for 2,000 years, you guys. It started because the church rapidly became Gentile-dominated. Now, praise the Lord, I'm not down on Gentiles, you guys. Most of you are Gentiles in this room. I'm very glad these people back in the first century and everybody today has come to be saved. But there's a lot of anti-Semitism existed in the first century, and the first century believers were never able to shake it off. And Paul saw it, Romans 11. Don't become arrogant against the natural branches. Remember the picture of the olive tree? Paul saw it already in the church in Rome. And so he was led by the Holy Spirit to write about it. Don't become arrogant against the natural branches. He was talking to the Gentile believers in Rome. They didn't heed the warning. The church in general has not heeded the warning of Romans chapter 11. And here's a little bit of the history. Here's some of the statements. Justin Martyr, he lived around 100 to 165, just after the first century, okay? What did he say? For the true spiritual Israel are we who have been led to God through this crucified Christ. So the true spiritual Israel is the church. Well, he began that trek. Origen, 185 to 254. Another church father. The Jews will never be restored to their former condition. God's done with the Jews. See? Replacement theology is already in place. Hippolytus of Rome, martyred the 13th of August, 235. Now this guy was committed to the Jewish Messiah. Okay? He died being loyal to the Jewish Messiah. But what did he say about the Jewish Messiah's people? The Jews have been darkened in the eyes of your soul with a darkness utter and everlasting. Hey, Paul said, I'm a member of the remnant. The darkness isn't complete. There's Jewish believers in this room. He's dead wrong, right? Of course, right. He's dead wrong, okay? But do you see where the charge of deicide has its origins? The Jews are solely and universally and perpetually guilty for the death of Christ. Do you see where it's coming from? See that there? We have been darkened with a darkness utter and everlasting. Sorry, dead wrong. Romans 11, 25 through 7, 27, all Israel shall be saved. I don't know what he did with that verse. I don't know what he did with it. All right, but he died. He died for the Messiah. And that's his opinion of the Messiah's people. Augustine. He did some more stuff than this. For if we hold with a firm heart the grace of God which hath been given us, we are Israel. The Christian people then is rather Israel. Now I respect these guys to a certain extent, but you can see I'm not enamored with them. Okay? Augustine. Now 1,000 years after Augustine, it's still going on. Martin, my good friend Martin, on the Jews and their lies. Remember that? Now I respect what Martin Luther did in the Reformation. But he came out of Roman Catholicism and he never shook his anti-Semitism. He never was able to shake it. The Jews, surely rejected by God, are no longer his people, and neither is he any longer their God. What does verse 5 say? What does verse 5 say? Though their land be full of guilt against the Holy One of Israel, Israel is not forsaken. Not forsaken by Jehovah of hosts. Did he pay attention to Jeremiah 51:5? I don't think so. And unfortunately, it goes right up to the present time. This is Martin Luther in 1400s and early 1500s, but today we still have it around. Knox Theological Seminary, a Presbyterian seminary. The Wittenberg Door, an open letter to evangelicals. You can read this. It's been on the internet since 2002. And this is what they say. This is just a slight snippet out of their whole document. Just a little bit. You can read the whole thing for yourself by going to their website. It is not as though the rejection of some in Israel for unbelief serves no purpose. On the contrary, because they were broken off in unbelief, the gospel has gone to the Gentiles, who now, through faith, partake of the blessings of the fathers. This is a reference to the Abrahamic covenant and the other covenants, see? The church receives the blessings of the covenants. That's what they mean there. And join with believing Jews to what? To constitute the true Israel of God. And who's the true Israel of God? The church of Jesus Christ. Okay? That's Presbyterian theology, replacement theology of the modern day. This is what this seminary in Florida teaches to this very day. Okay? So replacement theology is still there. But it runs counter to verse 5. Even in sin, God has not forsaken his people. He will discipline us. He will bring us to salvation. But he has no way cast us off. All right, on that cheery note, it's 8 o'clock, so why don't you take your break, and we'll pick it up right in the middle of page 546 in 15 minutes. Everybody got the time frames chart? We're all set to go? All right, the recording is underway. Okay, let's pick it up then in the middle of page 546 with instructions to the remnant. So in verse 5... we saw that Israel was not forsaken, even though she is full of guilt. And so then there's instruction given to this remnant in verse 6. Three commands are issued to Israel. Flee from the midst of Babylon, and each of you save his life. Do not be destroyed in her punishment, for this is the Lord's time of vengeance. He is going to render recompense to her. So you see the three commands under point one, flee, get out of the city, two, save your life, And third, don't be trapped in her iniquity. Is that the ringing up a little bit? It's this one over here. This first, not that one. No, that's not that one. This one right here. All right, can you still hear me? Okay, that's the big one. The fine tune is right there. Okay, is that okay? Sound system okay? All righty. Okay, so flee from the midst of Babylon. Save your own life. Thirdly, don't be caught in the midst of God's wrath. Because point two, he's going to pour out his vengeance upon Babylon. Babylon will get what she deserves. Babylon is about to receive the justice due to her in the tribulation period. All right, with that little glimpse of Israel past, on page 547, we come to point 12, and we get another picture drawn for us of Babylon. Top of page 547, Babylon is pictured as a golden cup. And we start in verse 7, chapter 51, verse 7. Babylon has been a golden cup in the hand of the Lord, intoxicating all the earth. The nations have drunk of her wine. Therefore, the nations are going mad. First of all, notice that this is worldwide in scope again. So this is the tribulation judgments. And Babylon here is pictured as God's tool. It's this cup filled with wine. And when a cup filled with wine is used symbolically in Scripture, it's a symbol of the wrath of God. The wine in the cup is a symbol of the wrath of God. The wrath is poured out, or people are made to drink of it. Jesus drank of God's cup too, didn't he? Take this cup from me, he said, using the same idea. So God has used Babylon to entice the nations, to get them drunk on his wrath. And therefore the nations are mad. They are suffering God's wrath. But then the tool that God uses receives its just recompense as well. The tool is not excused. And that comes out in verse 8. The tool does not get away with anything. Verse 8. Suddenly, Babylon has fallen and been broken. Wail over her. Bring balm for her pain. Perhaps she may be healed. And so once the content of the cup is consumed by the nations, once that cup is empty, then the cup itself is crushed by God himself. God's tool itself is judged. Point C, we come to the response of the foreigners living in Babylon to this event. Here's how they react to the destruction of Babylon. Verse 9. Verse 9. Here's their statements. We applied healing to Babylon, but she was not healed. Forsake her. And let us each go to his own country, for her judgment has reached to heaven, towers up to the very skies. So the idea behind this is that those who benefited from Babylon, the kings of the earth, the merchants, the shipping magnates, they all benefited from Babylon. They would have loved to restore her. They would have loved to receive the riches of a city that had been healed from her destruction. But they can't heal her. And so they have no choice but to, point two, forsake her. Each one has to go to his own country. They're forced to abandon her. She's been totally destroyed. And of course, we saw in Revelation 18, 9 through 19, point 1b there, that the merchants, the kings, and the sailors all mourned the destruction of Babylon. But what does the Jewish community do? Do they mourn the destruction of Babylon? Point D, bottom of the page, verse 10. These are the words of the Jewish community. The Lord has brought about our vindication. Come, let us recount in Zion the work of the Lord our God. And so the Jewish people are not mourning, they're praising God. Praising God for bringing recompense on Babylon. And of course, recompense is your just deserts, what you deserve. You receive what you deserve. So they say, let's leave, let's obey. Let's go to Jerusalem and tell our brothers. And so these Jewish people are making their way to Zion to proclaim the destruction, the work of God in the destruction of Babylon. All right, as we turn to page 548, our attention now focuses on the destroyer of Babylon. And finally, we learn who the leader of this massive coalition is. I've already told you who it is. I've been ahead of the scripture here, giving you a little hint. But now it comes out. Now it comes out very clearly. Verse 11. We begin with a command. Sharpen the arrows. Fill the quivers. The Lord has aroused the spirit of the kings of the Medes, because his purpose is against Babylon to destroy it. For it is the vengeance of the Lord, the vengeance for his temple. Now we've seen a number of themes come out again. First of all, the command is get ready for battle. You know, hold firm the shield. You know, make sharp the arrows. In other words, get ready. And we learn that it's the Lord himself who has stirred up the kings of the Medes. That term is plural. So those who live in the area of Media, there's a number of kings, a number of leaders that join together to destroy Babylon. They get the idea in their mind, hey, we can do this in. We can surprise Antichrist. We can do in the city. Now, this cannot be a reference to 536 B.C. when the Medo-Persians conquered Babylon, because the Medes played a very minor role in that. Cyrus, the Persian king, played the major role. Here we have Median kings, many Median kings playing the major role. So this is a future fulfillment. This hasn't happened in the past. And again, we see his purpose against Babylon is to destroy it. But notice point B2 in the middle of the page. This vengeance is again associated with the temple. This is the second time we've seen this. Again, the point is made that God knows all about the abomination of desolation. He knows about the fact that the Antichrist is going to set himself up in the Holy of Holies and declare himself God. And yet that is God's personal space. That is God's throne room. And the Antichrist has no place setting himself up in there and claiming deity. And that will be dealt with. So this vengeance is associated with the temple as well. Remember, this temple is not validated by the appearance of the Shekinah glory in the Holy of Holies, as was the tabernacle, as was Solomon's temple. And that will provide the open door for the Antichrist to walk in there. There's no way he could walk into the Holy of Holies with the Shekinah glory in there. He would have been vaporized. But there's going to be no Shekinah glory light. So he's going to march right in there, all proud and arrogant of who he is. But it's still God's temple. Okay, so get ready for the battle is verse 11. As we come to verse 12, it appears that the attack is underway. The attack has commenced in verse 12. Lift up a signal against the walls of Babylon. Post a strong guard. Station sentries. Place men in ambush. For the Lord has both purposed and performed what he spoke concerning the inhabitants of Babylon. So now these various military squads are out doing their job. guarding, ambushing, communicating, you know, doing all that's necessary to bring Babylon down. So in verse 11, get ready. Verse 12, attack. And in verse 13 comes a declaration of the results, the end of Babylon. Verse 13. Here's what will be, here's the results of the attack. Verse 13. O you who dwell by many waters, abundant in treasures, your end has come, the measure of your end. Now, verse 13 starts out with this phrase, you that dwell upon many waters, or by many waters. Commentators are not sure exactly what Jeremiah is driving at here. Some think that perhaps Jeremiah has a Babylonian myth in view. That's point A. Babylonian mythology taught that Babylon was built over a great subterranean ocean. Well, I think that's possible, but not very likely. More than likely, I think B is the proper view. More than likely, I think he's referring to the Euphrates River with all its canals and trenches and dikes. All the waterways coursing through the city gave the city the appearance of dwelling upon many waters or by many waters. So I think that's what he's referring to. The defenses of the city and the canals in the rebuilt city of Babylon. He states that the city is abundant with treasures. Again, the fact that this is the economic capital of the planet is in view. The most wealthy city on the planet. But the end of this city has come, and it's connected with the covetousness of the city. All this wealth, all this treasures was motivated by greed. And so she gets her just deserts. Now another cross-reference to this, we won't look at it, Zechariah 5, 5 through 11. Zechariah 5, 5 through 11 is another good cross-reference to look at in regard to this verse. Zechariah 5, 5 through 11. So we move on to page 549. God has declared that Babylon will come to its end, and so in verse 14, we see the defeat of Babylon. The soldiers get ready, the soldiers attack, and now the soldiers are victorious in verse 14. The Lord of hosts has sworn by himself, surely I will fill you with a population like locusts, and they will cry out with shouts of victory over you. So the verse begins by a solemn declaration. There is nothing higher than God himself. He is the ultimate, right? The ultimate ground of being. He swears by himself. He can't swear by anything higher. So this guarantees the defeat of Babylon. And then he says, I'm going to fill you with men like, your notes say, the cankerworm. Locust would be a better translation. In other words, he's going to bring hordes of soldiers into Babylon, like a swarm of locusts. And you know, I was thinking about illustrating this, and I ran across a great picture. Here is, I think, a great illustration of those hordes of soldiers. Oh, man. Isn't that something? And the guy who took this picture had a lot of guts as far as, you know, locusts can't hurt you. Like a locust can hurt you, but look at them all there. Like this is the way the soldiers will appear to the Babylonians, like locusts in the middle of a swarm. What a picture! Now we 21st century city dwellers in America, we don't understand this stuff. So I'm glad there's pictures to give us a view. But in Jeremiah's day in the Middle East, you understood what a swarm of locusts was like, and we just get an idea of it through a picture like this. We have termites. I'm going to come after you like a swarm of termites on your house. Huh? Well, if he was speaking to us, he might paint that picture, yeah. All right. Well, anyway, there are the soldiers. Hordes of soldiers coming against Babylon. And we know they're the soldiers because of point three, they lift up this shout of victory over defeated Babylon. These are the soldiers of the Medes. And now the focus of the chapter shines once again on the greatness of the God of Israel. We've seen that he's sovereign earlier this evening. Now we get another look at his greatness. So we begin in the first part of verse 15. It is he who made the earth by his power. So the omnipotence of God is brought out. Omnipotence means all powerful. He made the earth by his power, the big blue marble that we live on today. Second part of verse 15. Who established the world by his wisdom, and by his understanding he stretched out the heavens. So now we see his omniscience. To be omniscient means to be all wise. He's all powerful, he's all wise. And notice point 2a and b, it's wisdom and understanding that established the world and the universe. When we look at the pictures snapped by the Hubble, we're not looking at something that's the product of blind chance and evolution. The world says all of this is the product of chemistry and blind chance. But verse 15 says that all of this is the product of intelligent design. Right? I love that term. And all the guys involved in intelligent design are not necessarily Christians, but they are all theists. At least they've come to the right conclusion. God made this intelligently. When you start delving into the universe, you are amazed. Just amazed. So this world is a product of God's wisdom and understanding. Then verse 16 brings out the point that, again, that he is sovereign. Even these guys, you guys, even that is the product of his wisdom and understanding. Even though we might go, get those things away from me. I don't know why he built mosquitoes, but he did. Okay, all right, enough of that. Whoops. He did build mosquitoes and cockroaches, and he has reasons for all of that. And I'm going to talk with him about that, too. And I will probably be awed when he says, well, this is what I had in mind, Bob. Yes, just like Job. Yes, Lord. I repent in dust and ashes. Okay. His sovereignty is brought out in verse 16. When he utters his voice, there is a tumult in the waters of the heavens. He causes the clouds to ascend from the end of the earth. He makes lightning for the rain. He brings forth the wind from his storehouses. And here we see that God is sovereign over the weather. Sometimes we don't like it when it rains. There's a thunderstorm, but God is in charge of that. Point A, he talks about the storm clouds. He utters his voice and there's a tumult of waters in the heavens. That's the storm clouds, those big gray, huge clouds that come pouring out of the north. The evaporation cycle is brought out in point B. He causes the vapors to ascend. We know the cycle that causes clouds and rain and all that, that waters the earth. Well, that's what he's talking about here, the evaporation cycle and rain cycle. Then point C, he makes his focus on lightning. Every bolt of lightning comes because of God's knowledge and sovereignty, and then the wind as well. So whether it be a Hurricane Katrina or a gentle breeze on a spring day, the weather is at God's control. Remember, folks, the weather is not being controlled by the ozone layer in the Antarctica. All right? Our weather is not being controlled by the ozone layer in the Antarctica. The Lord is in charge. And that's what verse 16 very clearly points out. He's in charge of the weather. So I'll never complain about snow again, right? Actually, I've been down in Southern California long enough. I really miss snow and rain. I really do. Not all of you agree with me. But you see, I come from the Northwest, and there's water in my blood. There's moss on my back. People in Oregon are called mossbacks. The moss grows on our back and on our roofs and everywhere else. I miss that right now. All right. Moving on to page 550. We've just looked at the greatness of God in creation, omniscient, omnipotent, the creator. And now he's compared with the inferiority of idolatry. And idolatry will be very common on the planet in the tribulation period. It will be all amalgamated into the one world religion, the ecumenical one world religion, and finally its focus will be on the ultimate idol, the Antichrist. But listen to verse 17. The modern world does not like this statement. Verse 17. All mankind is stupid. Well, we are, guys.
Amen.
Regard to the Lord. No, there's not much. But he loves us. He loves us. Okay, all mankind is stupid, devoid of knowledge. Every goldsmith is put to shame by his idols, for his molten images are deceitful. There is no breath in them. Basically, his point here is idol worshippers, idol makers are the stupid ones. And the fact that they're stupid is pointed out by their rejection of God. They turn to idols. They build idols, things made out of rock and stone and clay that aren't alive. They're just junk. You know, that's pretty stupid to worship something like that. Where is the true source of knowledge? Write down this cross-reference, Proverbs 1:7. Here's the true source of knowledge. You want knowledge? The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. But fools despise wisdom and instruction and go to idol worship. Okay, Proverbs 1:7, the fear of the Lord. Also, Proverbs 9:10, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. See, this is where it starts. This is where it starts. And the knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. You see, the Bible ought to be a main subject of education in our school system. It was at one time, wasn't it?
Yep.
Isn't anymore. But it should be, because this is where wisdom and knowledge finds their root, finds their foundation. Well, people turn away from the Bible and they get into the great wisdom of evolution. They say that everybody is just an electrochemical accident. Well, that's pretty stupid. I'm sorry. I know an evolutionist wouldn't like to hear me say that. All right, that's the idol maker. Rejecting God, rejecting wisdom, doing the stupidest thing on earth. And then God's attention turns to the idols in verse 18. It's not 51:1 there, 51:18. Put an 8 in, the missing 8 in. So the idols that these men construct are now described in verse 18. They are worthless, a work of mockery. In the time of their punishment, they will perish. So idols have no power, they have no wisdom, they have no sovereignty, they can't protect themselves. They're just pieces of rock and metal and wood. That's all they are. Decorated up, but that's all they are. In contrast, in verse 19, in contrast steps forth the God of Israel. Here's the God who we worship, you guys. Verse 19. The portion of Jacob is not like these. For the maker of all is he, and of the tribe of his inheritance, the Lord of hosts is his name. So the portion of the Jewish people is not like idols, and all those who place their faith in the Messiah have been grafted into that. Your portion is not like idols either. Your portion is God himself, the Creator. It's very clear who it is here, Jehovah of hosts. Not Buddha, not Krishna, not all these other idols we've looked at in the past. All right, page 551. We've taken a look now at the futility of mankind's idol worship and the superiority of the living and true God, the only God. And remember, there is no other God. Now our attention focuses on the object of his wrath, Babylon, and a new picture is drawn. Babylon is now pictured as a hammer. And God is going to use this hammer to hammer the nations of the world, just like he used Babylon as a cup to pour out his wrath on the world. So we begin in verse 20. He says, "You are my war club, my weapon of war." So some translations have hammer, some may have battle axe, or whatever, war club is what my NASB said. But God uses Babylon as his tool. And so the shattering effect of this battle axe or war club is brought out in the second part of verse 20. Now, verse 20 through verse 20b through verse 23 is simply a summary of the wars of the Antichrist. The tribulation will not be a fun time. Three major world wars will occur during the 7 years of the tribulation, one at the beginning, one in the middle, and one at the end. It is going to be a time of mass warfare. And Revelation 6, verses 1 through 4, points that out very, very clearly to us. This is what Jeremiah is talking about in chapter 51, verse 20. Revelation 6, 1 through 4. This is the horseman of the apocalypse. Then I saw when the Lamb broke one of the seven seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures saying, as with a voice of thunder, "Come." And I looked, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat on it had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer. That's Antichrist. When he broke the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, "Come." And another, a red horse, went out, and to him who sat on it, it was granted to take peace from the earth, and that men would slay one another, and a great sword was given to him. That's the characteristics of the tribulation. Antichrist will conquer the world. It'll be a time of horrible warfare. So here's a summary of that warfare, starting in the second part of verse 20. With you, speaking of Babylon here, speaking of Antichrist, with you I will shatter nations. With you I destroy kingdoms. So nations are destroyed by Antichrist, conquered by him. Verse 21, with you I shatter the horse and the rider. Point two, that's a reference to the military forces. Verse 22, with you I will shatter the chariot and the rider. Again, a repetition of the idea that the military forces will be conquered by Antichrist. Second part of verse 22, with you I shatter man and woman. With you I shatter old man and youth. With you I shatter young man and virgin. I'm going to suggest some changes on your outline here, but in verse 22, the general population of the world is shattered. First of all, he says, I break in pieces man and woman. So there's no distinction. The warfare makes no distinction in relation to gender. Nobody is spared. The women are not spared. The men are not spared. Everyone is shattered. So there's no distinction in regard. I would cross out marital status there and put in gender. I think that's a better way to look at it. Gender. This is 3A. 3A. Instead of distinction of marital status, I would put in there distinction of gender. I would put in gender there. Man and woman. Point B. He says, I will break in pieces old man and youth. So there'll be no distinction in regard to age. So the young won't get a break during this warfare either. The old won't get a break of any sort. Everybody will be shattered. Thirdly, I will break in pieces young man and virgin. And here I would write in no distinction in regard to marital status. I would cross out the word sex there and put in marital status. That's more the idea here. So the general population will be shattered by Antichrist with no distinctions. Then the labor classes will be shattered by him. Verse 23. With you I will shatter the shepherd and his flock. With you I will shatter the farmer and his team. So the average workman, the blue-collar worker, suffers. But also the white-collar worker, too, in point 5 on page 552. And not only is it the white-collar worker, these are the governmental leaders. Verse 23b. And I will shatter governors and prefects. Your notes say dignitaries. And then, once the hammer of God has shattered all these different categories, that hammer itself will be destroyed in verse 24. But I will repay Babylon and all the inhabitants of Chaldea for all of their evil that they have done in Zion before your eyes, declares the Lord. And so the shattering hammer will be shattered itself, and the main reason here is the mistreatment of the Jewish people. The main reason for destroying Babylon, because it comes against the Jewish people. That's Satan's focus. We are his focus. And now another picture is drawn for us of a Babylon, the destruction of the destroying mountain. God uses many different pictures. Here's the picture of a destroying mountain. Verse 25. Behold, I am against you, O destroying mountain, who destroys the whole earth, declares the Lord. And I will stretch out my hand against you and roll you down from the crags, and I will make you a burnt out mountain. Now in the Bible, whenever a mountain is used symbolically, whenever the term mountain is used symbolically, it's always the symbol of a kingdom. Whenever the term Bible is used symbolically, it's always a symbol of a kingdom. So here we see the kingdom of the Antichrist destroying the whole earth. Apparently, the picture is that of a volcano. You know, erupting lava, destroying everything around it. So the whole earth is destroyed by this volcano of a kingdom. And then he says, once you're done destroying all the earth, I will make you a burnt out mountain, as though the volcano now has nothing left. It's just a burned out cinder, a volcanic cone with nothing in it. So the mountain has burned itself out as well, and it too is desolation. Just this black cone covered with burned out rock. And this desolation is brought out in verse 26. Verse 26. They will not take from you even a stone for a corner, nor a stone for foundations, but you will be desolate forever, declares the Lord. And so these blackened, burned out stones that are part of this mountain are good for nothing. And that's the point of point C. The destruction of Babylon is so great that not even its stones will be used for anything. Now notice point two, the very last sentence at the bottom of the page. You will be desolate forever throughout the kingdom. Now that seems to be a contradiction in comments there. How can something be desolate forever and only desolate throughout the 1,000 years of the kingdom? Well, it's pretty clear when you look at the original Hebrew there. The word rendered forever in the text is simply the Hebrew word olam. Now, olam means a very long time, an age. And when the word olam is used without modifiers, that's all it means. In order for the word olam to mean forever, you've got to use modifiers with it, like olam va'ed, okay, to a long age and beyond. You've got to use modifiers. But here, it's simply the word olam with no modifiers. So a better translation of the verse would be, you will be desolate for an age. And the age that we're looking at here is the 1,000-year messianic kingdom. So we're not violating any language or any biblical principles here when we have the notes there that say you'll be desolate forever throughout the kingdom. It should be you'll be desolate for an age, the 1,000-year messianic kingdom. All right, now we come to another picture of Babylon. Page 553. Now Babylon is pictured as a threshing floor. And the threshers are these enemies that come against Babylon. First of all, true to the pattern that we've seen, there's a call that goes out to the invaders in verse 27. Lift up a signal in the land. Blow a trumpet among the nations. consecrate the nations against her. First of all, point 1A, set up a standard. A standard is a rallying point. It was a very high pole, a very tall pole with a banner at the top of it. So set up the rallying point. Point B there, blow the shofar. That's the literal there. The trumpet is the shofar in the text. Blowing the shofar was a signal to gather. So set up the rallying point. Signal the nations to come against her. And then in verse 27, the nations that come against her are listed. These are the major players who come against Babylon. Finally, we see four of them. These are the four major players. And this is verse 27b, second part of verse 27. Summon against her the kingdoms of Ararat, Mini, and Ashkenaz. Appoint a marshal against her. Bring up the horses like bristly locusts. All right, here's our map of the Middle East. Now again, this is point 3, the destruction of Babylon. We're in Jeremiah 5, 27 through 28. And so we get a little look at the major players. First of all, he says, bring up the kingdoms of Ararat. Well, the kingdoms of Ararat are in this area. This would be Turkey and Armenia, that area. So the kingdoms located in that area. Then point 2, he says, bring in Mini. Mini is the area of Lake Van. This is Lake Van right here. And Lake Urmia. This is Lake Urmia right here. These two lakes. So this is the area of Mini. That's the area he's talking about. So stir up those nations. And then point 3, he says, stir up Ashkenaz. Ashkenaz refers to Germany and the Baltic states. That's where you get the term Ashkenazi Jewry. I'm of Ashkenazi background myself. Okay? Where's Ashkenaz? Well, it's way off the map here, way up there in the Baltics. So this fulfills that statement in verse 26 of chapter 50, where he said, gather forces from the farthest border. These guys are going to come from a long ways away. From the Baltic states, Eastern Europe. So here we go. These major players all gather to the north of Babylon. And they are described as bristling locusts in the NASB, which is a good term there. Better translation than rough cankerworm, because here's this picture of this army of locusts covering the ground. Remember the picture we saw just a few minutes ago? Bring them together like locusts, like a swarm of locusts against Babylon. Now, the leading nation, the nation that leads Ashkenaz, the kingdom of Ararat, and Mini, is brought out in verse 28. Verse 28. Consecrate the nations against her, the kings of the Medes, their governors and all their prefects in every land of their dominion. And so now we learn who the leader of this coalition is. It's the Medes. And of course, Media is located in this area here. Now, of course, the governors and the deputies, the prefects, are all the lower echelons of leadership. So they all gather, and then they move south against Babylon. Remember, they bring the Antichrist to his knees in surprise, because the movement of these armies doesn't surprise him. Remember, he's ordered the armies to assemble at Armageddon. The movement, worldwide movement of armies is happening all over the place at this time. That's his command. Most of them go right here.
So are the Medes Iran?
Iran, this would be Iran today, yes. That's the modern nation of Iran is this area today, yes. That's the modern nation of Iran. Mini, that's the stands up there. Afghanistan and, not Afghanistan, but Uzbekistan and all the stands up there. I don't know all the groups up there. That's all the stands, yeah. Tajikistan and, huh?
Which would be part of Russia.
Well, right now they're independent of Russia, but they have been part of Russia, yeah. But that's all the stands up there in that area. I don't know how many ethnic groups are up there. But he's talking in terms that Jeremiah and those in his day can understand, and that we can understand even in our day. The Medes were located here. Whether, of course, the modern boundary called Iran will not necessarily be in place then. We'll see what happens. But that's the area in which they all come. Okay, so the Antichrist is surprised because this movement of armies is something going on. But what surprises him is that they don't turn and join him. What surprises him is they come south against his nation, against his capital. That's what shocks him. So we don't know who these are. These are guerrilla forces. They're Gentile believers, apparently. People who reject Antichrist in the middle of the tribulation. In the middle of the tribulation, you have to receive the Mark 666, right? That mark is a religious mark. It's not a credit card, you guys. It's a religious mark. When you receive that mark, you're making a religious commitment. I am going to worship Antichrist. That's why the book of Revelation says, when you receive that mark, you cannot be saved, because you've made your religious commitment. All those who do not receive the mark still have the potential of being saved. And that's what these people are. They're those that reject the mark of the beast. And so they are apparently sheep Gentiles of the tribulation period who come against Antichrist and all that he stands for. Well, I'm just surmising. I can't. He may think they're with him because the armies are moving. He's given a command for the armies to move. They're moving, but they don't move at the very last minute. They don't move in the direction he expects. In the very last minute, they hit Babylon. Okay. That's, I think, is what happens here. They surprise him. Okay. What? And of course, then he goes after Israel. Yes. Well, those are all minor players. They're not mentioned in Scripture. Some of those nations will send their armies to join the assembly at Armageddon. There may be insurgents or guerrillas as minor players that join this army as well. Okay? We don't know.
So would those be called two wars? Then you said there's...
Well, this is all part of the campaign of Armageddon. This is the Third World War of the Tribulation. Okay, there will be insurgents from South America, Central America as well. They'll come from all over the world to join this army to destroy Babylon.
Because that's to speak some of the Central American, South American leaders are endorsing the president of Iran.
Sure. Yeah. They'll be a minority because the vast majority of the world will be following Antichrist. Okay, that's the vast majority of the world. This will be a minority, and that will be part of the surprise as well, because they will, empowered by God, destroy Babylon. But this is just a little hint as to what's happening. These are just the major players. Mene, the Medes, kingdoms of Ararat, the Ashkenaz. That's just the major players. There's a lot of minor players in there too, who are not even mentioned. Yeah. All righty. Well, that brings us to page 554 and to the conclusion of our study tonight. So let's pick it up next week on page 554 as we look at this destruction of Babylon. Let me go ahead.